This is a talk by Eberhard Riedel on January 13th, 2006, entitled Dreams.
For example, you may remember the dreams of the Egyptian pharaoh who called on Joseph as his analyst, as recorded in the Bible, or the dream incubation method employed by Asclepius for healing in the ancient Greece. Questions that will guide me tonight and during our classes over the next 4 weeks are: what are modern attitudes towards dreams and dreaming? Why do we dream? What is the purpose of dreaming? What is the natural function of dreams and dreaming? How do we arrive at the meaning of dreams? Jung, who lived from 1875 to 1961, of course, was keenly interested in the structure and dynamics of the in the structure and contents of the unconscious mind. My sound changes again, as well as the methods used for investigating processes originating in the unconscious. Can you hear me? Is this too loud? Is there an echo? Okay. These methods include the words association test, dream interpretation, and active imagination. Widely in public imagination, Jung is primarily associated with the subject of dreams. Why is a question we may want to pose later. Throughout the ages, poets, writers, and philosophers addressed the topic of dreams. The great Spanish poet Antonio Machado was born in the same year as Jung in 1875, says in a very moving poem, and I give you the second stanza, last night as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous error, that I had a beehive here inside my heart, and the golden bees were making white combs and sweet honey from my old failures. We're making white combs and sweet honey from my old failures. I read this poem in a group therapy session with a group of geriatric, chronically mentally ill individuals, including several suffering serious dementia. And the impact of that dream was such that first one woman and then another spontaneously exclaimed, "I have dreams too." And something deep within their disturbed minds responded, and the power of dreaming opened up work with them at a depth that I had not imagined possible. So I'm very pleased to know that the Jung Society is offering a workshop on dream work for people in their elder years later this spring. Now, though we possess records of dreams back to antiquity, the conceptions of dreams vary in different cultures and at different times. So I would like to ask you, what is your attitude towards your dreams? How do they affect you? How do you interact with your dreams? And also, why do you think you're dreaming? And do dreams affect you even if you do not remember them? I assume you have many more questions, and questions concerning understanding specific dreams I propose we take up during our classes. For now, let me start with the question, do dreams matter? I'll give you an example. In the spring of last year, I was on Hawaii And I just returned from a hike of 18 miles to take photographs of an erupting volcano. I felt great, I felt strong, I felt on top of it. But that night, I awakened twice by frightening dreams. In the first, I walk along halls in a hospital looking for my room. I'm dressed in a hospital gown. There are no doctors or nurses to provide information. I know that my name is on the door. I find the room, I see the bed, and it hits me, I'm on the oncology ward. After I fell asleep, a similar dream occurred, even more frightening, and it woke me again. Was there something badly wrong with me? For 6 months, I had been treated unsuccessfully for pain at the root of my tongue, and several physicians had assured me, if it hurts, it's not cancer. Well, I found another specialist, and 3 weeks after the nightmares, I underwent the first of two surgeries to remove squamous cell carcinoma. The dream may have saved my life. The tumor was still localized in situ. This is just one example of dreams sounding a warning and announcing a somatic or physical illness. There are also dreams that sound warnings concerning problems in the human cultural or natural environments, including impending war, natural disasters, or environmental devastation. An apt example precognitive perception are Jung's visions and dreams in the months prior to World War I, as discussed in Memory, Dreams, and Reflections. There's a mystery here. How does the psyche know? How does the soul know? In German, Jung uses the words psyche and soul, Seele, interchangeably. Since there may not be a rational answer to this question, let us consider what hints you might get from the mesopoetic stratum of the unconscious. According to a biblical legend, and I'm quoting Ginsberg's rendering from an article by Wittmann, upon conception, the angel carries the soul to the mother's womb and sets a light above her, whereby the soul can see from one end of the world to the other. The angel carries the soul around and shows her heaven and hell, and where she will live and where she will die. And he takes her through the whole world, points out the just and the sinners and all things. But upon birth, the angel flips the babe on the nose, extinguishes the light at his head. Immediately the child forgets all his soul has seen and learned, and he comes into the world crying, for he loses a place of shelter and security and rest. Yet, once having entered life on earth, the soul escapes from the body every night, rises up to heaven, and fetches new life thence for man. Every night rises up to heaven and fetches new life for man. Whitman continues, noting that we now know that recuperation through sleep, which the legend ascribes to entering heaven and fetching new life, depends not only upon undisturbed rest, but also upon dreaming. Interference with dreaming can create psychic and physical pathology. These examples suggest that dreams do matter indeed. In fact, I believe that dreams are indispensable for a vital psychic life. Dreams are the lifeblood of the psyche, And you see, dreams link different worlds. They connect us with the other. Dreams form bridges between thought and feeling, mind and heart. They stimulate our imagination, make us curious about things that we do not yet comprehend. They enliven, they animate, energize, warn, confuse, cajole. Is that why we dream? The American Heritage Dictionary defines the word dream as a series of images, ideas, and emotions occurring in certain stages of sleep. I emphasize images and emotions. Ideas and emotions. Dreams link images with emotions. They link ideas with emotions. The word emotions contains the Latin word movere, which means to move. Emotions move and affect us. We talk about emotions or affect. To me, affect is the main organizing principle in my psychological thinking and clinical practice. And affect is the bridge between body and psyche. Affect has a physiological component. You sense it in your body. For example, your heart rate may change. Your breathing may change. You feel it in your gut. The word consciousness refers to states of awareness. And at the center of such self-awareness is a me or an I, Latin word ego. So the ego is the center of consciousness. A connection with the ego is necessary for making anything conscious, such as perceptions, feelings, thoughts, fantasies, and dreams, but also for experiencing oneself as a center of desiring, reflecting, willing, and acting. Thus, for example, the body which the ego experiences is psychic. It's a body image. At all times, the ego is being impacted by events in the outer world and by events in the inner world. Examples of the latter are affect and emotions. They are autonomous. They happen to the ego without its bidding. The ego is continuously being impacted by internal and external stimuli, and at times feels quite overwhelmed. Yes? Jung's model of the psyche postulates two centers, the ego as center of consciousness and the self as center and circumference of the whole psyche, of all psychic processes, conscious and unconscious. Ego and self are not things, they are psychological experiences. For example, for Jung, the ego is the only content of the self that we know. And the self is experienced as a transpersonal, numinous energy, a God image. Furthermore, in Jung's model, the cosmos of the psyche is populated by complexes, and each complex has an archetypal core which acts as a conduit to some archaic, mythopoetic substratum which Jung calls the collective unconscious. Now, in my dream, seeing the hospital bed triggered a fear complex. That fear complex is colored by personal experiences with cancer, such as the death of loved ones or friends to cancer. At its core is a deep-seated survival instinct, which is universal, is not specific to me, and it prompted immediate action on my part. So complex, and then at a deeper layer. So I will have more to say about the experiences of complexes and the collective unconscious as we move along. So for now, let's just accept the model. The space of the psyche is populated by complexes, and there's some conduit to some archetypal realm. The basis for a self-aware, creative living lies in the capacity of the psyche for developing links between the human and the archetypal realm. That means for the me, the ego, to develop relationships with the human self, the human other, and some numinous transcendent other. And the key to psychological functioning lies in the nature and health of that relationship between ego and self. You see, this is where many remarkable dreams are located. They originate in the space between you and the other. Jung said, in the deepest sense, we all dream not out of ourselves, but out of what lies between us and the other. Psyche is not complete without the other. It needs to reflect itself, see itself. It needs a mirror. Dreams are a mirror in which the psyche sees herself. Dreams weave back and forth between thought and feeling, mind and heart, the inner world and the outer world, a me and a you, the human realm and the archetypal realm, an I and a thou. Dreams are the lifeblood of the psyche. They are a necessary factor for a vital psychic life. The unconscious is the generator of psychic energy. As the legend says, each night the soul ascends to heaven and brings back new life energy. I might add that the mythopoetic images of heaven and hell both refer to places of numinous energy. The Jungian analyst Russell Lockhart wrote, "The dream is a creative weaving of many threads woven by an unknown dream weaver. We are presented with a fabric with our own image woven into it in ways which we do not understand, which make no sense, which go against reality, which are paradoxical, which puzzle and perplex us." Hence, myriads of threads, like the veil of Maya, connect each of us with our own unknown nature. We are the tapestry. We are the weaving. However, the threads not only weave connections within a person, but also create uncountable links between individuals. And Jung emphasized again and again that without healthy bonds to the human other and the transcendent other, there exists no wholeness. He said, and quote, "Psyche is never complete in the individual unless related to another individual. The unrelated human being lacks wholeness, for it can achieve wholeness only through the soul, and the soul cannot exist without its other side, which is always found in a you. Wholeness is a combination of I and you." This is where dreams live, where they weave back and forth between different realms. Dreams emanate from the space between us and the other, the human other and the transcendent other. This is our theme song. Every night the soul rises up to heaven and fetches new life, making sweet honey from my old failures. Dreams are the creative weaving of many threads woven by an unknown storyteller, the unconscious. Next, I would like to consider the structure of dreams. If dreams mirror the psyche, mirror our psyche, then we would expect that they reflect its structure and content, and thus bring us into contact with our innermost being, as well as to to reflect the inner and outer dynamics, physical and emotional, that impact its well-being. As I mentioned, the psyche is organized by complexes, and Jung calls them feeling tone complexes. They live in our bodies. You all know, and you all have experienced what I'm talking about. We say, this is a hot button for me. You push my button. That's what we are talking about. When one of our complexes gets triggered, we find ourselves in the grip of the affect associated with that complex. The degree of disturbance from ego equilibrium as caused by the activation of a complex depends on the intensity of the affect or affects associated with that complex. Powerful affects can swallow the ego. We feel besides ourselves. In trauma states, the individual is overwhelmed by storms of raw affect, demonic terrors, or terrifying threats. The psyche is dissociated and may be possessed by spirits and demons. Primordial affect leads to violent splitting of the psyche. I mention the state because it gives you a feeling for the intensity of the affective energies associated with the archetypal core of our complexes. It is truly larger than human. And a dream example may illustrate the affective intensity such dissociative states can assume. The dreamer's mother had recently died, and as a child and later on, he had not told her about sexual abuse he had suffered for fear of killing her. He dreamt. Someone had killed my mother. I hold a hand-drawn picture of the murderer and pursue him. Concurrently, I dream that my wife has a correspondence with a man, and she tells me that she will not stop it. I submerge through a trap door into a world of sewers and stand face to face with the man who killed my mother. It is the same man with whom my wife has a liaison. The man laughs evil, and I know that I'm powerless. I had to scream myself out of the dream to wake up. Personified in the dream are different complexes, different parts of the dreamer, or if you wish, the different affective energies associated with these complexes. They appear like actors on a stage. Sometimes the dream ego, the dreamer, is one of the actors, as in this dream. But sometimes he or she is in the audience and just witnesses what is happening. You may think of a dream as a drama occurring in the psyche. There's powerful affect associated with that drama of body and mind. Being in the presence of an activated complex such as the trauma complex in the dream I just read can be a most frightening, disorienting, and dissociating experiment. Affect storms can have the strength of tornadoes and hurricanes. Psychological language and jargon tend to shroud rather than reveal these experiences. On the other hand, fairy tales and myths draw us right into the archaic and archetypal experiences. Fairy tales are the dramas occurring in our souls, the sane and the mad parts doing battle, the forces of imprisonment and liberation, death and rebirth at work. This is also the realm of dreams. They show us how our psyche herself deals with the inner drama. This is, of course, one of the reasons why for listening to our dreams. We learn about healing by studying the inner drama and ask ourselves how psyche deals with it. For example, in the above dream, The dream takes the dreamer into an underworld and face to face with the menacing shadow complex, the murderer. Healing required, dealing with that shadow domain. Shifting gears, I would like to talk about what modern science has to say about dreams. At the beginning of my analytical training, I had the following dream. I walk along a country road above the ocean shore, and then, turning onto a narrow path down to the beach, I receive the message, Einstein built a beach house out of driftwood. Einstein built a beach house out of driftwood. So let's build a beach house and start with a few observations. A dream is a reflection of the unconscious psyche. Dreams wake up the imagination. That tells us that the unconscious wants to be imagined. This is one of the mysteries of dreaming, how image stirs affect and affect stirs image. The scientific method deals with observable facts. And of course, getting obsessed with literal facts can dull the imagination. But don't be afraid of scientific inquiry either. Recall that Jung wrote, no science will ever replace myth. No science will ever replace myth. He advised, when struggling with your problems, go as far as you possibly can, using your conscious mind, the strength of your ego, then the unconscious will help you. And here's a well-known example of how that works. The chemist Kekulé struggled hard but could not figure out the molecular structure of benzene. The problem was how to arrange six carbon atoms with four valences each and six hydrogen atoms with one valence each as a molecule. Linear structures with side branches didn't do the trick. Now, the unconscious imagines. It plays. It puts building blocks together in different ways. And through a dream, offers a solution. The benzene ring was born. The year was 1865. The benzene molecule consists of six carbon atoms at the places of the hexagon and attached to each carbon atom a hydrogen atom with all of the 12 atoms in one plane. This was a crucial discovery for modern chemistry. Came out of a dream. The unconscious is amazingly open and versatile. And here I'm referring to Jung's observations as to the structure and contents of the unconscious. For Freud, the unconscious was closed, holding only personal repressed contents. Jung, on the other hand, as he listened to his patient's dreams and spontaneous imaginings, noticed that they were not only images of a personal nature, but also motifs of a collective nature belonging to all mankind, as expressed in fairy tales, myths, and the stories native to many diverse cultures. At one point, he exclaimed, there lives a 2-million-year-old man in us, and the old man or woman may speak in our dreams. Do we listen? An analyst of mine recently brought a dream in which he, the dreamer, was met by an ancient woolly mammoth, an animal which roamed our continent 10,000 years ago. This is so amazing. In psyche, our human ancestors live on. Extinct animals live on. Experiences of all ages live on. Jung research showed that psyche has conduits into ancient primordial layers of experiences of both physical and emotional existence. You may wonder why I'm talking about Jung under the subject heading of modern research on dreams. I think it belongs here. He had the insight that, and I quote, dreams and fantasies organize human behavior even when the subject is not conscious of them. In the same way that myths in earlier times suggested possible answers to life's principal problems. To me, the most interesting aspect of this modern research is the incorporation of psyche and dreaming into our thinking about development and evolution. Here are three observable facts. First, during REM sleep, we continuously dream. That means adults dream for about 2 hours every night, and children much more. Most dreams are not remembered. Experiment. Through selective deprivation of REM sleep, subjects were prevented from dreaming and subsequently developed mental and physical disturbances. Hence, REM sleep dreaming is both of biological and psychological importance. Second, dreaming is correlated with higher order learning and integration of new information. This has been proven in animal experience by severing neurological pathways to areas in the brain that are active in the theta wave phase of sleep. Now, this is not quite the same as REM sleep, but close. Three, in the human brain, there exist three major association cortices that provide essential pathways for sorting and integration of new information into the network structure of the brain. Specifically, the limbic association cortex has been correlated with dreaming. This association cortex is concerned with the integration of memory, emotions, and motivational aspects of behavior, and also receives projections from higher order sensory areas. That's why they're called association cortexes. They kind of bringing all these things together. What we learn from all of this is that dreaming is correlated with integration and learning. Remembering or being conscious is not preconditioned for this process. It's not preconditioned for this process. There are, of course, also dreams associated with cleansing the brain, for example, the elimination of information, and with healing the body. For example, there are dreams that relax an overly stressed body, like dreams of swimming with the dolphins or rhythmic skiing or dancing. But back to our question, why do we dream? What picture is emerging now? Remember our theme song, the soul moves back and forth between the two worlds and fetches new life energy. The motif of eternal weaving, back and forth and back and forth every night. Neuroscience studies the brain. Brain and mind, or brain and psyche, are different realities, different but not separate. Dreams have a linking functions. I believe that dreaming plays a role in connecting psyche and brain. That would also lead to the hypothesis that developmental pressures, and I would go so far and say also evolutionary pressures, are not only exerted by external but also by internal forces, i.e. the psyche. As I mentioned, this kind of learning happens without consciousness. It is not the ego putting things together, but it is this amazing dream weaver. Remember, Einstein built a beach house out of driftwood. Stuff comes drifting along from the outside or from the inside, unconsciously. There seems to be a principle at work that generates higher order starting from lower order building blocks, the driftwood. There are some kinds of stimuli or pressures for doing so. This brain-psyche manifold or body-mind system can learn without consciousness. The brain is a highly complex network. Learning is not just becoming aware of information. That means ego consciousness. For the organism, learning is also about storing information, knowing how and where to find information, and about connecting new information with old information. And all of this happens without ego awareness. Brain and psyche are involved in information management, which then gets translated into behavioral patterns. Dreams form a bridge between brain and psyche. Dreams are a series of images or ideas and affect. Affect is always part of the deal. Affect is always part of the deal. In a dream, an animal, another person, the dreamscape, all are embedded in feeling tone, which colors the experience of each aspect of the dream, much like color tones do for a painting. The feeling tone complexes are the drama in our psyche. They are the actors in our dreams, the subpersonalities populating our psychic space. This network, which we call brain, holds this information in incredibly fine detail. In terms of information management, it seems that recall occurs via affect labels. Images and ideas appear to be embedded in an affect space, which gives them their unique significance. We all have fathers and mothers. When your mother enters your dream, it is embedded in a unique feeling tone or affect. And this mother image stimulates specific affective responses in other dream figures, including the dream ego. It's a living miracle. I want to take these ideas one step further into an area of current research. I understand dreaming both as a result of and a force that organizes experiences in new ways. Einstein makes a beach house out of driftwood. Of course, the dreams which are remembered and possess a connection to ego consciousness can become motivational forces for conscious reflection and action. They stimulate curiosity and imagination. Dreams are generally experienced as imbuing us, the person, with emotional energy, regardless of whether the emotions are happy, positive, or difficult. Dreams tend to move us. Never mind that there are lots of dreams that seem to make no sense, either never remembered or quickly forgotten. There's lots of driftwood that never ends up in a beach house. Or there are beach houses which are torn down, and the driftwood is used for other structures, or not at all. So psyche also recycles. In the 1970s, the chemist and physicist Ilya Prigozhin studied ways in which order and organization can spontaneously can arise spontaneously out of chaotic conditions through a process he called self-organization. In my physics research, I studied systems of large numbers of interacting constituents which, when the environment is right, exhibit novel collective properties and order which are not inherent in the individual units, in the building blocks. And during the past 10 years, these ideas have been taken further in the study of what's called complex adaptive systems. These systems have self-organizing features turned emergent properties which occur in response to environmental pressures. Again, the higher order or the higher level emergent patterns have no resemblance to the properties of the constituent parts. Like in the dream, driftwood on the beach is one thing. The developmental competitive pressures, or the beach house, are quite a different matter. In this sense, we may think of dreams as the emergent properties of the dynamic developing system of brain and environment, both the physical and the psychic environment in which the brain is embedded, and vice versa, both the physical and the psychic environment in which the brain is embedded. And this way of thinking avoids the Cartesian split between brain and psyche and puts psyche on a par with external motivational spurs as driving development and evolution. More immediately, for our Jungian dream work, when higher level patterns, say symbols, enter into the realm of consciousness and are affectively experienced, then this may coincide with a sense of deeper purpose or function. Ordinary dreams, I'm talking again about remembered dreams, ordinary dreams give consciousness new contents. When symbols of the self emerge, then they imbue our body and soul with a numinous energy and profound change can take place. And I will give you some examples later. Well, I thought you might be interested in myth building. That's what we are doing here. It's a form of dreaming. And remember, Jung said, no science will ever replace myths. Are you waiting for the end of the tape, John?
That's okay.
Okay. Do you need a break, or do you want me to continue and then take a break and continue? Okay. All right. So, after dreaming onwards, let's look backward into history and wonder about where we have come from. And this discussion will also serve as an introduction into the question of different attitude towards dreams and dreaming and different ways of looking at dreams. During our classes, we will then practice several individual approaches to dreams and dream interpretation. Please keep in mind that dreams and dreaming are and were explored within the paradigms of three major disciplines: psychology and medicine, philosophy, and linguistic literary criticism. Adopting a historical perspective, let us ask, what were some of the sources of Jung's understanding of dreams? The typical answer is Freud, who published his interpretation of dreams in the year 1900. But this answer only reveals our amnesia. In the second half of the 19th century, dreams were one of the most written subject matters in psychology, and dream research flourished throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th century in Europe. And it seems that Jung knew most of these works. For example, Shamtasani, in his carefully researched book entitled Jung and the Making of Modern Psychology, published in 2003, He quotes an undated manuscript of Jung's that lists 78 writers on the subject of dreams from the period of the 19th century. Now, to impress you by the breadth of this work, I'll cite from just 9 authors using Shamdasani's work. I will read the author's name, the year, the quote, and give you my key word or label to fit it into our story. This will be a little bit like a fireworks, but it's to impress you.
The poet all the way to Paradiso and that famous last scene of the cosmic rose at the end of Dante's. In fact, one of the things, I wouldn't talk about this, but it's very germane to what we're going to be talking about in terms of Celtic recovery of the deep feminine. You know, one of the legends is that the last 13 cantos of that were not found when Dante died. He died in exile. There were stories that he hoped if he wrote this pure enough, he would be returned to his beloved home, Florence. They were having their version of red state, blue state, and his state's lost, and he had been exiled. And one of the rumors was that his son, Jacopo, had a dream about those 13 cantos, which held where Beatrice takes him and he perceives the final cosmic rose. And the dream told him...
Immanuel Kant, 1790, speculated that dreams and the purpose of dreaming... that dreams has the purpose of stimulating the vital organs by means of imagination. I call this the animating, energizing aspect of dreams. Friedrich Nietzsche, 1880, wrote, "In our sleep and dreams, we go through the work of earlier mankind once more. This old aspect of humanity lives on in us, in our dreams." The evolutionary aspect of dreams. Remember the dream with the woolly mammoth. Gotthilf Heinrich von Schubert, 1814, stated that in dreams the soul spoke in a hieroglyphic picture language of symbols. Dreams stemmed from the poet hidden in us, and their language was poetic and metaphorical. The metaphorical symbolic aspect of dreams. Remember the beach house. From the mid-19th century onwards, we see a cyclization of dreams. James Sully, 1893, observed, "The dreams strips the ego of its artificial wrappings, and it brings up from the dim depths of our subconscious life the primal instinctive impulses." I would call this the associationist aspect of dreaming. And Sully and the philosopher Foucault, whom I mention next, were major influences on Freud's thinking about dreams. Johannes Foucault, 1875, articulated a relation between the dreams and the unconscious and stated that there were two groups of dreams, those that stemmed from the body and those that stemmed from the mood. He wrote, "In the dream, we are near the innermost world, admittedly not with what we experience through the dream images, but what we unconsciously do and are in the dream-forming process." What we unconsciously do and are in the dream-forming process. Remember my discussion of... what learning means, the learning that happens on the unconscious level. I would refer to this as the autonomous unconscious aspect of dreaming. In the 1880s and 1890s, saw an increasing emphasis on memory retrieval, which makes a psychotherapeutic use of dreams an obvious choice. Pierre Janet stated that the therapeutic significance of dreams was that they often revealed the pathogenic event. He also held that dreams enabled one to monitor the state of the rapport between the patient and the doctor, what we now call the transference-countertransference field. He noted It's a curious psychological dream work which takes place in us without our knowledge. It is thanks to this subconscious work that we find problems completely resolved, which a little time before we did not understand. That sounds a little optimistic, but the diagnostic and therapeutic aspect and uses of dreams. And Janet, Duprel, Meyers, and Flourney were major influences on Jung. I have quotes from the other three. Carl Duprel, 1875, emphasized the dramatic form of dreams and also their healing capacity. He wrote, "In dreams are exhibited other forces of the human psyche and other relations of the psyche to the whole of nature than in waking life." And that in the dream, the sleeper first experiences influences from his own interior, and his consciousness thus obtains new content. That was 1875. So what I said wasn't really new. 1875. The subliminal and generative aspects of the unconscious as revealed through dreams. Frederick Myers, "Consider dreams in their aspect as indications of the structure of our personality and as agencies which tend to its modification." And he made very clear distinction between the activities during waking life and dream life or sleep. And this led to a shift of gravity away from studying conscious processes to the subconscious, or subliminal strata, as it was called. So the individual personal aspect of dreaming. And finally, Theodor Flourney built on Janet's notion of the unconscious and stated that subliminal dreams and fantasies serve two functions. They were compensation for one's difficulties in life, and they had a teleological function. By the latter function, he meant helpful, protective impulses that prepared the future. So significantly, dreams were not solely concerned with the past, retrieval of memory, but possessed a future dimension as well. The compensatory aspect and the teleological or prospective aspect of dreams. So this concludes my firework, examples of research on dreams during the second half of the 19th century. And those of you who know Jung's work will recognize major building blocks of his approach to dreams. And those of you new to the field have just heard a summary of its principal components. Let me get on to my final section. And I want to say a few things about how do we listen to dreams? How do we listen to dreams? In a nutshell, dreams tell us something new that we do not yet know. Always look for the new, the unexpected, the most unusual image, the image that holds the most affect for you. And I would like us to consider two examples. The first illustrates the compensatory nature of dreams, and I use one of Jung's dreams. The second example shows the profound healing power of numinous dreams and discusses a dream of a mother who lost her child through an accident. Here's the first example. Frequently, one-sided attitudes get us into trouble, at least me. To explain what Jung meant by compensatory nature of dreams, he used a dream of his own, which occurred when his work with an analyst caused him, quote, "a steadily mounting sense of excruciating futility. He dreamt, "I was walking along a country road, through a valley lit by the evening sun. To my right, standing on a steep hill, was a castle, and on the topmost tower, on a kind of balustrade, sat a woman. In order to see her properly, I had to bend my head back so far that I got a crick in the neck. Even in the dream, I recognized the woman as my patient. Jung then tells us, quote, "From this I concluded that if I had to look up so much in the dream, I must obviously have looked down upon my patient in reality." End of quote. The dream prompted him to consciously confront a previously unexamined countertransference disdain, whereupon he says, quote, "The treatment shot ahead beyond all expectations." End of quote. Please note that it is not the dream that is compensatory, but how Jung used the material to confront an ego attitude he discovered was one-sided. It's not the dream that was compensatory, but how he used the dream to correct a one-sided ego attitude. Operationally, in this integrative process, there are three steps. The first step is let it happen. Let the unconscious speak. Be open to experiences, what it may have to say. For example, hear the dream. Second, consider it. This may start with writing down what you're experiencing, the dream. Let it impregnate you. Allow it to puzzle you. Allow it to make you curious. And then third, confront oneself with it. Try to understand the messages of every dream image and then realize them in actual life. For example, correct an one-sided ego attitude as in the previous dream. Now the second example shows the religious function of the self at work. The dreamer is a mother who had lost her child in a bicycle accident and for a long, long time was overwhelmed by suffering, loss and grief, and anger at God and the world. Then she became aware of feeling stagnation, being stuck, unable to move beyond her deep-seated day-to-day grief. Her dreams, when she remembered them, had become dark. Later, when she read some of Simone Weil's work and reflected on the dark night of the soul, she felt a resonance. She began to wonder, perhaps God had not abandoned her, but was only hiding. Then she had the following dream. "I'm in a dark hallway with my friend Jay. I know she is dying from ovarian cancer, and I'm very sad. I hug her and feel how thin she is. Then I leave, going outside into the street. The street is shiny, wet with rain. I look into the roadway and see an apple sitting on the pavement. Just then, a large black car comes racing down the road, runs over and crushes the apple. I run out and pick it up. When I look at the crushed fruit, I see a golden key giving off a bright, warm light." In this dream, notice the stark contrast between the darkness of death through cancer and the warmth and luminosity of the light-giving key. Living with the dream and its images slowly set changes into motion. The woman began to sense that her grief and bitterness were a cancer that was killing her slowly devouring her from inside. She had focused on trying to suppress an overwhelming fear that the evil which had taken her daughter threatened to devour everything that was precious to her. Then she witnessed the accident, which destroyed and revealed. A light-giving key is hidden in the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. She said, "I believe that the luminosity of this dream and the image of the golden key were as transformative for me as the voice out of the whirlwind was for Job." She felt that God was no longer hiding, but through her suffering, a God image was incarnating in her. She said, "Although nothing had changed, everything was different. Although nothing had changed, everything was different." And this is the message with which I want to leave you tonight. In the numinous light of a new self-symbol, here's a golden key. Everything is different. A new day dawns. And to me, this expresses the eternal mystery of dreams and dreaming. I thank you for your attention. Good night and good dreaming.
Thank you.
I'm not daring to answer it. In which ways are they the same, in which ways are they different? That's the question you're asking. There are similarities, but aren't there also differences? Yes.
You know, and it felt like a dream feels.
Yes.
And it's like, that's what it comes to. Mm-hmm. Some experiences that feel have a dream-like quality in terms of, for example, even religious experiences.
Yes. And this question of, is dreaming going on all the time and during our waking state, is only covered by all the inputs that we get through our senses, is a problem that people are thinking about and researching. And it is quite possible that moments as you are describing are like the little peaks of an iceberg. But I don't know. Connie.
Shut down or rerouted.
What really then is happening in terms of, I mean, can you describe what is happening psychologically then to the psyche when it's in this dissociated state? And why, you know, and violence particularly, well, how is that related?
Well, the basic mechanism is that the psyche gets flooded by affect of larger than human affect, by affect that comes from deep layers of the archetypal psyche, from the core that I mentioned. And taking your example of violence, quite frequently the violent person, the perpetrator, is besides himself or herself. He or she is in the grip of some demonic power. And as if that person becomes a conduit for this very high charged energy. And when you have a child or the victim, that is basically what overwhelms, because the individual is not prepared. And one of the recent theorists who thought about this is Kalshet, whose book you may know on the, how is it called, The Inner World of Trauma. And his idea, which is very close to Jung's idea, is that parts of the healthy self encapsulate in order to be kept safe. Say in the fairy tale of Rapunzel, Rapunzel is in the tower. She's kept safe, and it takes other psychological processes to get her out of the tower. So the mechanism that Kalshet might call the self-care system. And in fact, many of the personality disorders we probably can think about in similar terms. During our development, affective energies overwhelm us for which we are not yet prepared, then the psyche deals with them by splitting off, by dissociation, pieces that normally are united and work in tandem, no longer work in tandem. They become splinter psyches, and that is most likely one of the mechanisms of character disorders and personality disorders, clinically speaking. Say, when we're talking about sexual abuse of a child, the child has not yet reached the level at which through fantasies, etc., etc., he or she has come ready for a sexual relationship. If that happens before the individual is ready, so the normal development, then exposure, the abuse, opens apparently these doors to the archetypal world, and the person is flooded with these high energies. So these are some of the mechanisms that people are talking about these days.
So can I infer then sometimes in dreams that information is given to a person that they're not ready to deal with, and that can result in more traumatic response to Or are you always ready to psych? You always know that the unconscious always know when you're ready for the information.
Well, you're raising a topic which has been considered quite a bit with post-traumatic stress, and there seem to be dreams that do re-traumatize. And the question then often is, how do we work with dreams as clinicians that have the nature of re-traumatizing? There's some approaches where, for example, sand play has been used in some VA settings, veteran hospital settings. So that the topic is not being dealt with through language, but the individual is allowed to bring out the context in some symbolic way. The idea is to get it out of the system. But the issue of re-traumatization is a very serious one. Yes?
Do you know anything about the notion of potentially setting up a dream for the benefit of some other person or persons? Setting up to have a dream that is intended to assist with the healing of someone else, or some sort of benign outcome for someone else?
For someone else. Not dream incubation for your own healing, but dream incubation that with which you desire to affect someone else. Interesting question. Anybody here who knows about this?
I don't know if I know about that yet. I have a women's group, and we bring dreams, and it has been a couple of times when someone has had a dream and described something that another person in the
world blew off. Mm-hmm. Yes. It certainly happens in close relationships that you wonder now, is the other person dreaming my dream? But that's a little different from the way I hear your question. You talk about dream incubation for the purpose of healing. Yes, in the sense that the shaman's activity is digesting, is metabolizing an issue of another. But again, it doesn't seem to be right how I perceive the question of intentionally incubating. Would you think that a shamanic healing is close to what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm really just asking a question. My experience is pretty limited.
Okay.
We'll see what develops as we go through.
Okay. Yes.
How does this relate to active imagination?
Well, Jung taught, and Jungians still teach, the use of active imagination to re-enter a dream in a meditative state, and that may be close to the question you asked earlier. Re-entering the dream and, for example, allowing the dream to move on, or you wake up from the dream and you think, wow, I really should have asked this other actor on the stage some questions. And Jung, as wise there, active imagination would be to move into that meditative state, move into the space, the psychic space of the dream, and allow yourself to reconnect with those energies, with those affective energies. And the idea is to not let the ego take over, but the ego is just the observer, so that the process can return to some autonomous nature. Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, what would you say about somebody, and you can imagine who that might be, who doesn't have much of a dream type? For instance, when I go see my therapist, he says, well, any dreams, I always say no. And so for a while I thought I meant that I was very highly individuated, but I'm thinking but I feel cheated, you know. I feel like I'm not getting, you know, what I need to get. But
what is it that you're not getting?
Well, if dreams give you insights and knowledge, I guess I feel maybe I'm not getting it. Tonight I'll probably have it for Lynn.
Are you signed up? The question you're raising is how can we train ourselves and help ourselves to remember more dreams? And in my experience, when my dreams feel paid attention to, when I, for example, make an effort to remember to record, have my little notebook next to my pillow, talk about my dreams, share a dream. There's often a dream wants a dream. You share with your friend a dream and say, oh, this reminds me. And that your psyche begins to realize, oh, I'm wanted. An invitation. And even during the night, if you scribble down only a few sentences or an image or an affect, you probably can use that as a nucleus for remembering more the next morning. And from there it can grow. At least that's what the experience of many people is. Are there other helpful responses to her question? Yes?
I think one of the thoughts that occurred to me when I asked your question was whether you feel like you have to have a dream for your therapist.
Yeah. I don't.
To make sure that we have the dream just for you.
Right. No, I don't. That just happens to be.
That just happens to be what happens. Because sometimes I've had the experience of working with someone who very avidly wanted my dreams, and I would stop them. So that just came out of my own experience of feeling like we can be a little selfish about her.
I call this my dream screen. Suddenly there's a word or a sentence or something. Einstein made a beach house out of driftwood. And little sayings. And do you write them and put them on the refrigerator door, or I mean, how do we live with them? That's a good question.
And what is the implication of just having words versus image? There's still a feeling from them.
Right.
But it will just be this word.
Yeah, no, some dreams seem to be more idea or word and affect rather than an image and affect. And I don't really know why this sometimes happens this way and sometimes happens more with the images. But I'm familiar from my own experience what you're describing. Sometimes with strange words it helps to look at the etymology of the word and do a little bit of research on the word, because that sometimes often opens up new word meanings. There's a lot of history in the words we're using. Or start using the word and do some kind of associative process, like the writers do. Start with a word and you bubble out, and all the words that come to your mind. That creates another kind of web. Now, whether this web you decipher any meaning from it, it's a different question. But it does create another kind of aliveness. Living with it, I don't have a good answer. Yes.
You used the term affect a fair amount tonight. Could you tell us a little bit more about what specifically you mean by affect in the context of your talk?
I use emotion and affect synonymously. And I differentiate it from mood, which kind of more of a background energy.
Is it ever appropriate to look at resources of archival symbolism when you have a big dream, archetypal dream, and try to find what the white horse means?
Well, why not?
When I
gave you a few examples from the 19th century. They made lists and books full of dream symbols. And the only issue is, does it take us away from ourselves? Because it can become an exercise in itself. And in the end, everything is connected with everything else. So what? But if there's energy in it for you, by all means. And there's some very good dictionaries of symbols. But I don't believe in using them in any mechanical way. And furthermore, a horse or an eagle or any of the archetypal symbols never occurs in isolation. It always is embedded in a context. And to really make sense of the image, you want to see it in the context. And a horse against a white background and a horse against a black background, well, just to give two contexts.
And the symbol of transformation is the only symbol of that.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
That, like dreams, you say, can be a bridge to the unconscious. For me, a synchronicity can just penetrate very deeply.
Mm-hmm. Maybe starting from the outside, metaphors or language that are used in the context of dreams as something emergent from these complicated systems like brain psyche has also been applied to the idea of synchronicity by a Jungian analyst. You see, there are two issues here. One is, do we want an explanation for synchronistic events, or do we want to live in the mystery of the synchronistic event and deal with how it is shaking us, how it is surprising us, how there's another aspect to experience that is not causal, that is not in our usual time, linear time, cause and effect, but in a world where we are sitting on some kind of trajectory where we can look backwards and forwards in time, or where spatial arrangement is not in the usual way. And what you said about comparing synchronicity and dreams, that resonates with me. It's another way of, here's something for you to know. Here's something for you to look at. And I would go so far to say that, like I said with the dreams, here's something which has to do with what you do not yet know. And yes, there seems to be a language of synchronicity. Do any of you have any comments on the experience of synchronicity or want to speak to the question? Okay, let's go back to the questions. Okay. Go ahead.
How much work has been done to look at dreams that a person's recorded over a long period of time, for a decade or two decades, to look at the interconnectedness of what energy the subconscious, the way I understand it works, is pushing us towards our unity? Does there tend to be, over a long period of time, interconnectedness, or the series of dreams we have more to do with the point in time we're at in our life when that dream occurs?
Okay. There seem to be, for most of us, at least where research has been done, some major themes. It's almost like different waves and different dream motifs that come up again and again, but over time change. With regard to research, where you can read, Jung has looked in one of the alchemical volumes at a large number of dreams of one of his analysis. And not even all. I think there was something like 400 dreams over a long period of time to precisely from the question that you are asking. And there's several major themes, and each theme evolves over time.
So the themes may reoccur more randomly, and there's multiple themes running simultaneously, and they kind of leapfrog over each one? Or are you saying that the theme's more compartmentalized over a period of time? It sounds like you're saying that the same theme reoccurs over a long period of time in conjunction.
Several themes. I mean, it looks almost like wave, and then sometimes this theme comes up and this. But in each, you can follow evolutions.
So it's like multiple sine waves, right?
Whatever waves. Themes.
And can you look at that particular theme, or even with multiple themes and stuff, do they tend to point to some information that any of those dreams, or just several of the dreams, wouldn't necessarily connect you to? Like, if you're going back to the historical analysis, you don't have the data or available, but you research around the topic and look to see, you know, where the arrows are at, where they're pointing.
I'm very careful with as much as possible to avoid interpreting a single dream. In my work, in my practice, I listen to many dreams, and over time, in collaboration, with teamwork with the client, we learn how his or her psyche talks. And we try to sharpen our inner ear to that very unique, specific language. As I mentioned in my talk, when your father or your mother appears in your dream, it is embedded in a very specific feeling tone. And other dream figures respond to it in a very specific way. So, and this shifts over time when dreams become more archetypal. That was the question that was asked earlier. And then we go more to the universal themes. But typically that happens when we have done enough work on some of our complexes, our personal complexes. Then dreams tend to become more archetypal in nature. Thank you very much.
The library's going to be open for 15 minutes or so. If you need to check for the hour return, and then also make sure you go to the class.
So any.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.